After a long and painful. Some of you in this room know her, and some of you do not. But it is clear in the world that during the time of mourning, we are all going to be. The fear is still so great that we cannot speak the name. Only our friends can mourn. Newspapers will not be able to say. Who has the last few bodies that we have done for us? We will not remind us that he is really God. And he's always there when we need him. And we will be without her. Just as they have ever said about generations of people who have been through life, struggling to survive, having the courage to survive. And then except for our individual moments. Surely it is at times like this that we can see the importance of our lives. It's not just the way that the things that we left us. We're doing this work within that life. More than anything we can do at present, it will illustrate what might even make it easier for you to do on any schedule that is so important to us to recover. I would love to find out because it was one of the few things. Community is a little bit more difficult. Thus far, we define community as a group of people who have, who hear certain music and a certain kind of language, common dress styles, the meanings of certain kinds of rituals are similar in the community. And it's not defined by a place necessarily, you know. Although we have certain places in the city, as well as others, where more Latinos work than other places. And we really fought it out with the pieces of land for ourselves out of defense. What we're doing is an oral history, and oral history has some kind of interesting origin. Just prior to the 20s, the concern of historians shifted from the lives of great men to the lives of common people. And during the 20s, one of the only ways to be able to get certain history, certain stories, was to run around tape recorders and get those lives of people before they died. Because people that were spoken to and whose stories were given were people that were ex-slaves. The ex-slave narratives have many of them have been published. They're wonderful, wonderful stories of a changing culture, a lot of pain, and the way people have centered their pain. Labor history has also been done through oral history, talking to people who have been in the beginnings of labor unions and their struggles for rights and the history of strikes, and things like that. It's a real important part of oral history. The Appalachian Mountain people who have left no written documents of their history have also had many of their lives recorded. And I brought a couple of books here to try to look at. One of them is called Our Appalachia, an Oral History. This is one of the Foxfire books. I think there's five of them out now. They teach you how to do stuff, you know, how to make soap and how to weave. But they also have the stories of the people in them who do it. And they're marvelous stories, both men and women. More recently, women's history has been being recaptured in oral history. And Sherna Bluff, who teaches at Cal State Long Beach, has put together this wonderful history of five American suffragists called From Parlor to Prison, how they got involved in the suffrage movement in the early 1900s, how they got sent to jail, what happened to them, and what they're reflecting on now, and all that went there. This was a wonderful book that I just stumbled at by accident in the library, Quilters with New Domestic Art. And it's not only the story of how women put quilts together, but how we put their lives into those pieces of fabric and what it means to their lives to, you know, to put pictures of their children and their windmills and their corn crops and, you know, into their lives. And there are photographs of the women and their houses and their quilts. I wanted to say one more sample of this. This is not oral history, but part of it is documentation, and this is shown in the archives. And it shows what can be done with pretty good research, wonderful resources, and we hope that he's putting out a new book. To think that when some of this came out, it would be impossible to have found a book called Gay American History. And it's just phenomenal, who would think that it could happen.
Yes. Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit about how you do an oral history, how we do it anyway. Okay. We begin by locating people who are willing, who lived in the community, who are willing to share their memories with us, right? And the main difficulty we find here is that because of oppression, which both Joan and Deborah spoke about and Madeline, that most people do not feel that their lives are worth sharing, you know? So I guess the whole purpose of today is to inspire people to know their lives are worth sharing. But it's really extraordinary. I remember approaching a 60-year-old woman who came out in the 30s and asked her if she would do an oral history. She said, "Well, I don't have anything to say. It's not important. What would people want to learn from me?" And I think that's the general feeling that many people have. Now, one thing that I did want to share with you that, because I bet even, I'd say most people in the room would say, well, maybe it's true for other people, but not so true for me. I wouldn't have much to say. That all the first interviews that we did, it was extraordinary how much lesbians have to say about their lives. I mean, you can't believe it. Like, nobody. one.
It was one for work. And in fact, we were so excited, we just breezed through these 10 interviews, first 10, 12 interviews. And now we've become self-critical because it's clear that people have a million times more to say than they ever said on these tapes. And that we were just so happy we would stop after 2 hours, right? Good, you know. And now we realize that people have a tremendous amount more to say. And before we start interviewing people again, we are probably thinking of extending the time that we have done a few people who allowed us to come back 3 times for 2-hour sessions. And I think we're going to move in that direction more because it's clear people have much more to say than they ever thought they did. Right? Now, once someone agrees to, oh no, before I go into that, I want to explain one other thing, because right now, at this point in history, everybody knows about market research, Gallup polls, and those kind of interviews. And I want to explain what's the difference between that kind of research and being interviewed by us, all right? Now, the thing is that an oral history isn't really an interview. And the real difference is in any kind of interview, like a survey or a market research thing, that the interviewer, the person who's asking the questions, is central, and they have control. They define the questions, and they make it clear to you that they don't want too complex an answer. They want a simple answer, right? But that's not what oral history is about. Oral history, really the narrator defines the interview. The interview is as long and as broad and whatever as the narrator has to contribute. And it's really totally the narrator's initiative about how it's formed. And the interviewee, the interviewer, us who are asked doing the interviewing, we're not the central people at all. That we're there to kind of guide the oral history narrator to cover all the topics that we think might be important in constructing a lesbian community. And we're there to kind of spark off people's memories. Because, you know, it's hard. You start talking about the 20s. How do you, or the 30s, how do you begin to think about that, right? And it's us to begin to spark off some memories, because memories need to be sparked off. So that's really our job. It's not there to get a simple answer or the correct answer or the right answer. It's really there to get people giving a history that then can be shared and construct a history of our community. Now, once somebody agrees to be a narrator, we get together with them, and it could be one or two of us. Three of us haven't yet done an oral history with anybody. So far, it's been either one or two of us together. We even meet at the person's house or at our house. And beforehand, we give them a list of topics that we're interested in learning about. This is so that nobody, so people really do feel assured that there's no surprise questions, there's no trick questions, there's no difficult questions, that we're just interested in learning about ordinary day-to-day things, and we're interested in ordering them in time so we can sort out the changes and stuff. Now, up till now, we just gave the people a list of topics at the beginning. Now we're thinking of, we might be giving them to the narrators a week in advance, so people have a chance to collect their memories and think about it, and, you know, sort through what's important, what's not important, what they think we'd like to hear about. Okay, so I want to give you an example of the kind of topics so that people will see that they're common everyday things, but you can see once you begin to put them together, we could have a history of the lesbian community. Okay, now one of them simply is coming out. That's discussed by all narrators. I guess the goal there is to understand what it's like coming out in different periods, whether it's different coming out in the 30s, whether the 40s or the 50s, whether it's similar. Another important topic is bar life. We'd like to know more about the bars as they existed in Buffalo, how they transformed, the kind of music, the kind of dances, the atmosphere. Like, for instance, we were very surprised to find out when people told us about Ralph Martin's in the 40s that it was not as oppressive as some bars later on might have been. And our image is that everything was more oppressive longer back, you know? Things like that, they're very important to know about as we construct history. We'd also like to know, what's the role of the bar in relation to the rest of the community? Is it central to people's lives? Some people's lives are central to some it isn't. We need to know more about those things. Okay, another thing where one of our topics is couples. You know, how do people meet? How do people court? How do they relate with one another? Does that change over time? Like, we found out that in the 40s, The butchers always went out on Friday night, and the fans did not. Things like that. Other things that we've been asking everybody about is friendship. How do lesbians make friends? Are they usually your ex-lovers? How do you, or do you have some people who are, would be friends and some people, you know, are potential lovers? How that works out? People might be interested to know that the study in California has come to be shown that lesbians and gay men, contrary to the image of us growing old alone and being isolated and falling apart, that we have better aging support systems than the straight community. All right? Yeah. 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 We always put the cake out if we didn't go through it and look things historically. Another topic that we talk about are cliques and sects. We want to know how people become part of cliques and sects. Are they the central way that the community is organized? Is everybody in some clique or set? How they define themselves? Like, is it right to talk about the sports set, the bar set, you know, things like that? So we have to find out about those. Another topic we've been working on is sexuality. Now, we really...
narrow-minded at the beginning. We asked very
you know, short-end the questions that we started at the beginning with, well, when did you come out, and things like that. What we've been working to has been to set up a supportive environment, and that's where that question that Madeline gave, that we didn't start with that question, but now we use it. We ask people to, at the beginning, tell us what they think would be important in writing a book. And that kind of sets a good supportive tone and reminds people that they are really contributing this, and we're trying to compile it and get an overall picture. Also, to improve our ways of being interviewers, we found we had to do some background research. That what's clear to us is the more we know, the more people remember. Like, and you all can probably understand that. Like, the first people who had to tell us what the bars in the 40s were like, they didn't tell us so much about bar life. But the next people, we said, well, what was Ralph Martin's like? Ralph Martin, but everybody, you know, that, you know. See, so really, we have to get more information in order to, you know, help people spark and get in touch with their memories. So in addition to trying to listen carefully to what people tell us, we've been doing some library research in the Bohemian Buffalo community. We've done some research in medical archives. We've done some research on newspapers to figure out what are some of the gavets. Arva will talk a little bit more about that. And just in finishing, I wanted to mention that it's not simply that the commute that we'll pull together something that might be a book on the Buffalo lesbian community, but we found that the process of doing it is exciting for us, but also for the people who are narrators. That people are excited that as they begin to tell a story or their sense of their lives as lesbians, that things begin to fall into place and you get more of a sense of pride and sense of worth about your history.
Well, I imagine by now people are most anxious to find out who can be narrators for our project. And the answer is that anyone can be as long as they're interested in doing it. We're most interested in interviewing people who are 40 plus and have been out for at least 15 years. The initial way we began finding people to interview was we started with our friends, and there were a few easy reasons why we did that. One was because we didn't have the problems of trying to locate and make initial contacts with people we didn't know. Second, because as any narrator, they know a lot and we wanted to get it down. And third, and probably most important, was that we knew we could make all our mistakes on them and they would forgive us and allow us to come back and re-interview them. It wouldn't be too pissed off. From there, as people talked, and we would ask them questions and they would think about different issues, it would always pop up, well, you know who you should talk to? You really should talk to so-and-so, because if you want to know about this in the 1930s, they're the person who know it. And so we would solicit their help, call them up, ask, you know, if they would be interested, and that's more or less how the contacts got made, from friend to friend to friend. To date, we've interviewed about, I guess, 20 women, ranging in ages from their 30s to the 70s. And they've included white, black, Puerto Rican, Native American, working class, and middle class women. I don't think we can emphasize too strongly the profound contribution that women over 40 have made to our project. And this is not to minimize what we learn from every narrator, but it is to point out that women over 40, especially those in their 50s, 60s, and 70s that we've talked to, have not only obviously experienced more, but they're really the only people who know a history over time that can bring the perspective of what's changed and what's persisted. And that's what you need to develop a history in order to begin to ask the questions why. In terms of our future interviews, we're most interested in focusing on women in their 50s, 60s, 70s, as well as black women and Puerto Rican, Native American women. We know that regardless of their age, so that we can make sure we can capture the full diversity of lesbian life and not just document one section. We know from just doing readings about jazz subcultures in the 20s and 30s that black gay communities have existed, and we want to make sure that Buffalo is represented in this history. The last issue we wanted to talk about was anonymity, and we feel very strongly that the success of our project is largely related to how successfully you preserve the anonymity of our narrators as to what they say and who they are. We have very firm guidelines that we work by, and we wanted to detail them for people. First of all, when somebody agrees to do an interview, first names are only used. A person is never known by a last name, and often pseudonyms are used if people choose. Within interviews, if people get talking, especially as they progress, you forget that the microphone is there, and often people will mention full names or whatnot, and we go through and erase them. In terms of who can listen to the tapes, only the three of us can listen to the tapes. If somebody who's done an interview wants to listen to somebody else's who's done an interview, they can arrange that, but nobody else listens to the tapes. The other thing is that not only do other people not listen to them, but in terms of when we talk, you know, just to our friends or publicly or whatnot about what we learn, if we only generalize about trends that we've learned, we never relate stories or whatnot that could point to an individual in terms of identifying somebody. What's going to happen to these tapes is after we finish the book, we're going to index the tapes and develop a tape archive. That's so for future research, if say somebody's interested in coming out in the 30s, bars in the 40s, or roles in the 50s, they can know precisely where on the tapes to go for their research. We haven't developed a policy yet on who will have access to the tapes in the archive, but a guiding principle will be, again, preserving the anonymity of the people involved. There's problems about all this anonymity because it's very difficult to try and construct a history of an anonymous people. And it's difficult for us in a couple different ways. One is that people are not only careful of themselves, but also mindful of their friends, so that when they're talking about their lives, they don't want to give too much that, you know, might be recognizable as somebody who, say, does not want their life known or added in this way. We're not interested, really, specifically in names, you know, last names and addresses of who your friends are and, you know, and who they've been. But what we are interested in is, are your friends the same today as they were in the 40s? Who's the members of your clique? Has that remained the same? When you sought lovers, do you get your lovers from your clique or from other cliques? How do these cliques interrelate? And if we don't have names, then we can't, it becomes very difficult to try and put it all together to really see social trends in terms of what a history has really meant. We're not sure what we're going to do about this. One thing we thought of is maybe to have people beforehand give pseudonyms to all of their friends. That solves one problem in that in the actual interview they can talk about their friends, but it doesn't solve the other problem that everyone's going to have different pseudonyms, and so you're not going to pick out the people who, say, are members of six different cliques and have had historically special functions in the community as being social organizers or somebody that a whole lot of people go to for advice or whatnot. So we don't know what we're going to do with this yet, but it is a problem. The other issue of anonymity that problematic for us is what we do with people who have passed away information we have on them. That is, we found newspaper items from the 20s and 30s that the way the articles were written never mentioned they were lesbians, but we read them and said, aha, these are lesbians, and then we took them to some of their contemporaries and they said, of course they're lesbians. And some of them, here's what happened. So we have these wonderful pictures, we have all this information, and we have their names, and now, you know, we still hold firm to preserving people's anonymity, but we just, it's very problematic. Because I guess what this all leads up to is that, given the nature of gay oppression, we're not going to have a full lesbian history until it's no longer shameful or dangerous for names to be mentioned. Just the last thing we wanted to talk about is that we were really fortunate that we were able to bring the archive people here to be part of this presentation, because we don't think that there's any way that people could get a sense more of what lesbian history can be or what it has been, except through seeing visually, you know, know, what's going on and what's all part of this. In order for our project to be really representative, we need a lot of help. And I guess we've come to the point of the workshop that it's the plug. And then, there's several areas, ways that people can participate and help the project along. One, of course, and most important, is to be a narrator and give an oral history. Short of that, if you're not over 30 and you haven't been out since 1970 or whatnot, you probably know people who have, and that we need a lot of assistance to get to people that we don't already know or who might be reluctant or have a lot of reservations, just to help make linkages with us so that we can talk to them just over coffee or something. Talking to them doesn't mean that you're going to do it, but just let us, you know, get an in so that we can at least tell them what the project is about and maybe soften some fears and get them to a point where they would agree to do an oral history. The third thing that everyone can contribute is the memorabilia, a lot of which was illustrated through the archive show. That is letters, old pictures, newspaper clippings, diaries, journals, old novels, greeting cards, poems, anything. One thing that one woman gave us that will just tell you that, you know, she could have thought that this was a nothing, you know, that didn't mean anything, and I want to just spend a minute telling you about it. She gave us a newspaper clipping of an obituary that she knew she had it for years and it wasn't even dated. She didn't know. We found out since it was 1935. And she had saved the clipping because in the clipping it had referred to you know, her beloved friend, and so it was assumed she was a lesbian. But most importantly, she saved the clipping because the woman was beautiful, you know? And so she saved this clipping. And so we got this clipping, and it was a rather full obituary since she was a society lady. And that clipping that was not even dated opened up a whole new area of research for us, the world of artists, performers, and bohemian culture in the 1920s, and how lesbians, the role of lesbians in that. And so it was something that simple that we were so much further ahead just because somebody had handed that to us. The other thing is that this is not local to Buffalo, but there's two researchers, Vern Bulow and Bonnie Bulow, and they do research on sex history and the history of homosexuality. And Bonnie Bulow's mother recently died, and in going through her stuff, she discovered that her mother was a lesbian and that her mother had kept notes for years and years and years on the lesbian subculture in Salt Lake City, Utah. There must be, you know, this reasoning, there must be the Buffalo counterpart sitting in somebody's attic that we're waiting for. So, that's just to say that anything, you know, that people have is really helpful in the contribution that's most needed.
Okay, so now, before we go into questions for both, for the three of us and for Joan and Vera, we put kind of like flyers on our project that people can take with them, so remind them to encourage their and their friends' contribution of things that will help our project or encourage people who could help us. So I'm going to start them in each side of the room. People see one in the description of the project and one in the urge. Of us. Okay, anybody want to ask any questions about the project or the Lesbian History Archive?
Just one, something we didn't get a chance to talk about. Since the archives is a sort of ongoing, I don't want to use the word institution, because it's not our word, but there are a set of principles, and they're on these sheets. Which you also have to think about, but I just thought it's just around 10 principles on which the archives are based. And it begins, the archives must serve the needs of the lesbian people. All lesbian women must have access to the archives. No credentials for usage or inclusion. Race and class must be no barrier. And this is one of the traditional problems with archives is you have to be a special person to get in to use them. And so what we're saying is how we run the archives is sort of our politics and our culture in action. B, the archive should be housed within the community, not on an academic campus that is by definition closed to many women. The archive should share the political and cultural world of its people and not be located in an isolated building that continues to exist while the community dies. If necessary, the archives will go underground with its people to be cherished in hidden places until the community is safe. The archive should be involved in the political struggles of the lesbian people, a place where ideas and experiences from the past interact with the living issues of the lesbian community. Next. The archive should be staffed by lesbians, so the collection will always have a living cultural context. Archival skills shall be taught one generation of lesbians to another, breaking the elitism of traditional archives. The community should share in the work of the archives, contributing material, indexing, mailing, creating bibliographies, and other forms of information sharing. The archives will collect the prints of all our lives and not just preserve the records of the famous or the published. Its atmosphere must be nourishing, which means food. No, other things, but must be nourishing. Entry into our archives should be entry into a caring home. And I'm just reading this because we see this sort of as a, something to discuss, but as a model for all lesbian archives. The works of all our artists must be preserved, our photographers, our graphic designers, our scribblers, our card makers, our silversmiths. The lesbian feminist archives must refuse co-option from the patriarchal society around, even if it comes in the name of a woman's college. The collection must be kept intact and never be bartered or sold. The archives is an act of mothering, of passing along to our daughters the energies, the actions, the words we live by. It is the first step in reclaiming a place and time. And then there should be regional lesbian archives preserving and gathering the records of each lesbian community. A network can be set up. And that's one of our, that we usually say, it would be wonderful if every community of lesbians had its own archives.
You know, people must feel real passive because we went on, I mean, although the slide tape was relaxing, but there was a lot of talking, but if people could just kind of relax and then think of things they want to ask us about.
Brokers, in the sense, it is a full-time job to run the archives and make it available. What we hope the collection will do is encourage women to pursue research on their own. And for instance, we would not presume to interpret the lives of women, for instance, black lesbian women. We are preserving records so other women can do that. But what we would do is have that information available. Hopefully, in some time, we could pursue it or make arrangements. If a woman came to the archives, for instance, who had roots in the New Jersey area, and that, but because it's not, we don't want to be seen as controlling material, but just collecting it and sharing it. And sometime that information will be dug up. It's not necessarily by us, by someone who has connections, but anything like that we would treasure.